Welcome to this Texas Public Radio Town Hall meeting on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm Texas Public Radio's News Director, David Martin Davies. Tonight, we are turning our attention to the 1965 Voting Rights Act, a law that, after being passed almost 50 years ago, is again controversial. We are looking forward to a civil discussion about the topic. We also have mics for the audience so they can come up and ask questions and offer comments about the Voting Rights Act. I'm going to introduce our five panelists, and then we're going to listen to a radio feature about the history and the present challenges to the Voting Rights Act. And then we'll go down the line to get comments from our panelists, and then we'll open up to the audience. So let's get started. Here's our panelist. We have Henry Flores. He's a professor of political science and the dean of the graduate school at St. Mary's University since 1986. Dr. Flores has served as an expert witness in more than 50 federal voting and civil rights lawsuits. Next to him, we have Gilbert Garcia. He's a political reporter with 16 years' experience reporting throughout the Southwest. He's written extensively about the redistricting debate and the voter ID law. He currently writes for the online newspaper Plaza de Armas. He's recently published the book Reagan's Comeback. And here to my right, immediately, we have State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher. Martinez Fisher is currently in his sixth term representing District 116. The San Antonio Democrat is also currently chairman of the Mexican American Legislative Caucus. The caucus is one of the most visible opponents to the Republican-led legislature's congressional district maps. And here immediately to my left, a rare time for you to be on the left, George. I have George Rodriguez. He's the president of the San Antonio Tea Party. Rodriguez and the San Antonio Tea Party are a vocal supporters of both the maps drawn by the Republican-led legislature and the Texas voter ID law. The Tea Party is also critical of the Voting Rights Act. And all the way to the end here, we have Trey Traynor. He's an Austin-based attorney specializing in election law and government relations, a former general counsel to the Texas Secretary of State. Traynor advises numerous elected officials and political organizations on compliance with state and federal election regulations. He has been intimately involved in Texas redistricting. We also did invite the Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott to participate, or someone from his office. They declined. Now, the Voting Rights Act didn't just pop up in Congress one day in 1965 and get passed. This landmark civil rights legislation was the culmination of a long struggle. We're now going to listen to a report about how the Voting Rights Act came to be.
It was on a Sunday, March 1965, that about 600 civil rights activists marching for equal access to the ballot box were heading east out of Selma, Alabama, on U.S. Highway 80. When they got to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, they found a wall of state troopers waiting for them.
It'll be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue. Is that clear to you? I've got nothing further to say to you.
The marchers did not disperse, and the troopers, with their newly deputized recruits, charged, pushing the peaceful activists back up the street and then to the ground. Troopers rode in on horseback into the crowd. Tear gas was fired at the protesters, and the authorities began beating the activists with their state-issued batons, chasing them back into Selma. The confrontation was captured by a national news crew, and the images were featured on the nightly network news. Soon, the Reverend Martin Luther King would be in Selma, calling for calm, but also demanding change.
We are going to walk nonviolently and peacefully to let the nation and the world know we are tired now. We've lived with slavery and segregation 345 years. We waited a long time for freedom. We are trying to remind the nation of the urgency of the moment. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time.
It was days later that President Lyndon Johnson would cite this atrocity on the Edmund Pettus Bridge when he addressed a joint session of Congress.
There long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. Many were brutally assaulted. One good man, a man of God, was killed. There is no cause for pride in what has happened in Selma. There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy and what is happening here tonight.
He called for a new law to protect voting rights. The result was the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It gave the federal government the teeth it needed to enforce the 15th Amendment. Passed in 1870 after the Civil War, it prohibited the government from denying a citizen the right to vote based on that citizen's race or color. The Voting Rights Act was signed into law by LBJ on August 6, 1965.
There were those who said smaller and more gradual measures should be tried, but they had been tried. For years and years, they had been tried and tried and tried, and they had failed and failed and failed. And the time for failure is gone. There were those who said that this is a many-sided and very complex problem, but however viewed, the denial of the right to vote is still a deadly wrong. And the time for injustice has gone.
President Johnson knew he would have a very difficult time getting it through Congress. But the bloody events of in Selma, Alabama, gave impetus to President Johnson to push congressmen to pass that law.
Mark K. Updegrove is the director of the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library in Austin.
I don't think there's any single law that he passed in his prodigious legislative career as president that matches the Voting Rights Act. And I would say that he would be most proud of the Voting Rights Act, because passing the Voting Rights Act gave African American people and people of all colors in this country a real voice in the electorate. And giving them that voice gave them real political power and leverage.
Since 1965, the Voting Rights Act has been used by the federal courts and the Justice Department in a number of ways, including reviewing redistricting. Federal judges are looking to see if the new maps were drawn with the intent to sap away minority voting strength. And questions are being raised about the current redistricting maps in Texas, and that's what's held up our state primaries. And the Voting Rights Act is also being used to reject the Texas voter ID law, which was passed in the last legislative session and signed by Governor Rick Perry.
And this isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. I think any person who does not want to see fraud believes in having good, open, honest elections, transparent. And one of the ways to do that, one of the best ways to do that, is to have a identification, photo identification, so that you prove you are who you are.
Perry was recently on Fox News and explained the state's position in challenging the Voting Rights Act.
Here we are in 2012, and the idea that somehow or another the southern states, and Texas in particular, a state that is a majority minority in our public schools now, is somehow or another being discriminatory towards minorities, I think is a vestige of fear tactics that have been used through the years that frankly don't hold water anymore.
Opponents of the voter ID law say it discriminates against minorities. The U.S. Justice Department found that the law disproportionately disenfranchises registered minority voters. Hispanics disproportionately lack either a driver's license or a personal identification card, and that disparity is significant. As part of his defense of the voter ID law, Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott has filed a court challenge to the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. He says it violates state sovereignty. The challenge is likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what would President Johnson think today of his signature law still being fought against? Updegrove says he's sure LBJ wouldn't like it.
My guess is that President Johnson would be disconsolate over the fact that that the crown jewel of his legislative accomplishments was being challenged by various states throughout the country. And he would urge for a reasoned approach to voting rights. As he always said, come let us reason together, and I think he would want reason to prevail in this case as well.
And that's what we're doing here today. We're going to reason together about the Voting Rights Act. This is KSTX, the Town Hall Meeting on the Voting Rights Act. You can follow us on Twitter. The hashtag is KSTX Town Hall. Now let's turn to our panelists for their take on the present state of the Voting Rights Act. And we'll begin with Dr. Flores. How is the Voting Rights Act used in redistricting? If we didn't have a Voting Rights Act, how would things be different in Texas for minority voters?
Well, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act requires several jurisdictions. There are seven states and a broad array of other sub-jurisdictions, townships, counties, parishes, depending on the state that you're speaking of, that where there has been a finding made to Congress that a history of racial discrimination exists in those particular jurisdictions. And Section 5 requires that any one of those jurisdictions, they're called covered jurisdictions because they're covered by the law, that any one of the covered jurisdictions, when they make or propose a change to any part of their election structure or system or processes or laws, must send that change to either the Department of Justice, Division of Civil Rights, and the Voting Rights Section for preclearance. And that section makes a determination to decide whether or not the change will negatively impact the minority group that's covered by the law in that particular state. The other option is that instead of appealing to the Department of Justice, the jurisdiction can send it to the District Court of Washington, D.C., and ask for the court to make the same sort of recommendation on the proposed change. Without Section 5, the jurisdictions that have a history of racial discrimination could change any kind of election law that they wanted to. They could move polling places arbitrarily, discriminatingly. For instance, in early polling places in Bexar County, a number of years ago, the county decided that it was not cost-effective to have the early voting place at the Barbara Jordan Center on the east side of San Antonio because there weren't very many people casting ballots over there during the early voting process. Somebody called the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the attorney for voting rights attorney there called Bexar County and says, you cannot shut that voting place down because you didn't pre-clear it with the Department of Justice. So even the smallest change, the county argued, we're going to save money. And said, saving money is not part of the law. Saving money weighs less in the balances of justice to the rights of the voters, and which must be protected under the law. And so Bexar County just, you know, they kept the polling place open. And as far as I know, it still is open for early voting. So that's just a brief example of, one, what the law covers, and two, what it would be like if it didn't. In redistricting, any jurisdiction, a school district, the city of San Antonio, the state of Texas, has to submit the redistricting plan that occurs that they do every 10 years to DOJ or to the DC court for preclearance, and they have to look at those districts to see if there's any retrogression involved. In other words, any advances made by Hispanics or African Americans or Asian Americans that occur because of their protection of the Voting Rights Act, if that change regresses their position and they go backwards because of that change, then it won't be approved. So that Section 5 is really kind of a preventive kind of measure that protects the rights of Latinos and Blacks and Asians in the state of Texas.
Okay. Gil Garcia, how has the public dialogue changed recently about talking about the Voting Rights Act? It seems that it wasn't that long ago that a politician really wouldn't have openly challenged it. There had been some stigma involved. And state Republican leaders have charged that Attorney General Eric Holder is extra tough on Texas in enforcing the Voting Rights Act. Have we seen any evidence that of that at all?
No, I don't think we've seen that. But, you know, I think this has been building for a while. I mean, they're in the early 80s. Basically, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was an emergency provision that was included because, you know, we had the southern states had this history of discrimination. And the original idea was that it was going to be in place for 5 years and then it would come up for renewal. And it's been renewed four times since then. And I think when it came up in 1982 for a 25-year extension, there was some private there were some questions in the Reagan administration about this. I mean, they had some doubts about whether this thing should be extended. So it's been going on, but I think the intensity and the volume has we've seen it increase in recent years. And I think I think it's fair to have a discussion about the question of whether something that was an emergency provision, and a tremendously effective one, by the way, because when it came into play in 1965, state of Mississippi had 7% African-American voter registration, and within 2 years, it was up to 60%. So that was it was an amazing accomplishment. I think there's a fair debate to be had on whether this is Section 5 is something that we will want to have permanently, whether these nine states are going to be subjected to different sets of rules from the other states. And I think when it comes to voter ID, I think the strongest argument that people have in opposition to Section 5 is to say, well, you know, we've got a few states who are being scrutinized on voter ID, and then other states have voter ID laws, and they're not being scrutinized on it. But the thing that stands out to me is that the people who are opposed to Section 5, to continuing it, and the people who want to see it go away, are generally the same people who support voter ID. And when they oppose Section 5, the argument that's generally made is this is a remedy for a problem that no longer exists. This is a remedy for a problem that went away. That's ancient history, and Texas has and the southern states no longer have this pattern of discrimination. And it seems to me that you could make a very good argument with voter ID that it is a remedy for a problem that has not been proven to exist. We have no solid evidence that we have widespread examples of people going to election sites with someone else's voter registration card and trying to cast a fraudulent vote. And so I think that the part of the problem is that a lot of time and energy and expense has gone into this voter ID, these voter ID laws, and the same argument that I think opponents of Section 5 would make could very easily be made against voter ID.
Thank you. Representative Martinez Fisher, about the voter ID law, we frequently hear that having a photo ID is needed for cashing a check or even buying Sudafed. Why should voting be held to a lower standard than just, you know, buying Sudafed? And would you support the voter ID law if the state put the necessary resources into a program that would provide photo IDs to anyone who wanted one?
That's a really good question. First, you know, let me thank you, David, for bringing us together, and like to thank Texas Public Radio for bringing an important issue to the forefront, and thank you to Trinity University's Department of Political Science for sponsoring. You know, they say campaign after campaign, they're probably saying it somewhere tonight in Illinois, that every vote counts. You hear that all the time, that these elections come down to every single vote. Every vote matters, and we should get people to vote. I want to tell you a story about a woman named Thelma Mitchell. Thelma Mitchell is 93 years old. She cleaned offices in the state capitol in Nashville, Tennessee for 30 years. And while she worked in the Capitol in Nashville, Tennessee for 30 years, she had an ID with her picture on it. Thelma cannot use that ID today in the state of Tennessee to vote. And because she was born by a midwife in 1918, she doesn't have a birth certificate. And the state of Tennessee will not provide a means for her to obtain a certificate to prove who she is. And it didn't matter for 30 years when she was in and out of members of the House and members of the Senate in the state of Tennessee cleaning their offices, taking out their trash, cleaning up after their mess. Nobody seemed to care that she was who she was when she was sweeping the room, but all of a sudden now she cannot vote. And the problem is that buying Sudafed, getting on a plane, buying a pack of cigarettes, those aren't constitutional rights. But the right to vote is. And while the government certainly has a role in regulating and legislating and coming up with reasonable ways to make sure that you are of age to buy a pack of cigarettes and that you are of age to buy alcohol and that you can buy Sudafed without running a methamphetamine lab. But why should the government step in the shoes of censor and decide who gets to enforce their constitutional rights and who doesn't, especially in Thelma's instance, where she did nothing wrong? She was born at a time where things were very different, particularly in the South, and there are many people like her. And so if every vote truly matters, and if it's important, and if we mean what we say when we say that, then when we legislate these issues, we don't create solutions in search of problems. We identify the problem, and we fix it. We all know, everybody in this room that studies this issue knows, that the real fraud in voting may exist with respect to mail-in ballots and how they are applied for and how they are channeled in the postal system and how they're voted and accounted for. This legislation does nothing to even address that issue. Why don't we focus on that? And let's take it one piece at a time. And if we are going to engage in a debate and discussion about having an ID to do more than get on a plane, let's do it in a way that is fair. Here in San Antonio, we have three Department of Public Safety offices. None of them are open after 5. None of them are open on weekends. You won't find one downtown, and you won't find one west of downtown. And so is it fair to the people that live in those communities that they have to miss work? If they don't have a driver's license, my sense is many of them are not driving and have to travel from far west San Antonio to the southeast side to get a driver's license. I think we can do a better job. This is not the idea. This is not the solution. There's certainly not been a problem. And I would care about the rights, the constitutional rights of Thelma Mitchell before I would chase something that doesn't exist.
Mr. Rodriguez, as the president of the San Antonio Tea Party, you've said that the Voting Rights Act is no longer needed. So are you confident that minority voters are not targets for voter suppression by the states? And how do you see the Voting Rights Act as a violation of states' rights?
I see this situation that we're facing in Texas as one where it's not about race and ethnicity. It's about a party. Hispanics, just because you're a Hispanic does not mean that you're a Democrat. And Democrats have even criticized Henry Cuellar for negotiating with the Attorney General. They were upset that they're more upset about party losses than they are about the Hispanic political diversity. The fact of the matter is that there is Hispanic political diversity. And probably someone like myself, who is a conservative and bilingual and bicultural, is probably one of the nightmares for some of these folks. The Democrats shouldn't blame racism at this point. They should be blaming the fact that they have a race-based message that can't attract a diversity of voters, and so therefore they can't win certain elections. Naleo has done extensive research, and the figures show that there are more than over 100 local Hispanic elected officials in the state of Texas. So I have to ask myself, where is this discrimination that's prevalent and awful that's going on right now? The fact of the matter is that there is political diversity in the Hispanic community now. There are Hispanic Republicans, there are Hispanic conservatives, there's even Hispanic Tea Party members. So the issue is not that we should continue punishing a state for the sins of individuals 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, and that it's time to move on. At what time does it quit being a nanny state that you handle and coddle and push along? At what point do people stop pretending that racism is like the boogeyman to scare people to come to vote? It's really, really time to stop it. The other issue is that we can see it very, very clearly when individuals when Hispanics are marrying, intermarrying with Anglos and with African Americans at a high rate, well, it's called integration, folks. It's called integration. And that should be something that we should be happy with. We should not be balkanizing America any further. I do oppose it, and I feel that it is really, really a problem. This law addressed a problem in the past, but to continue pushing it and to continue supporting it at this point, I think it's really, really, all it is discriminating against the state of Texas and discriminating against Americans just because they are not a certain ethnicity or race. You are discriminating against them, and that's the bottom line.
Mr. Traynor, you've been on the inside in Austin during redistricting conferences. There's nothing wrong with redistricting to benefit one party over another, but how do you guard against drawing lines that hurt minority-dominated communities?
Well, I think when you look at the Voting Rights Act in the context of redistricting, and we've started this entire conversation off talking about race, but if you read the Voting Rights Act, it's actually written as a race-neutral piece of legislation. It has no one particular race in mind. And what has happened is, as time has gone on, it's been the politicization of the Voting Rights Act that's caused the problems and now leads to the call to do away with the Voting Rights Act. And so sitting on the inside, drawing maps in a redistricting process, while Dr. King in the clip that we just heard talked about the fact and often spoke about the fact that we should achieve a colorblind society, the first thing that happens in the redistricting process is that you go through and you identify what are majority-minority districts. You go through and identify the Hispanic districts. You go through and identify the black districts. And you see what the benchmark is for those, and you make sure that you hit those benchmarks again. So if you have an increase in population in the Hispanic community, like we've seen in the state of Texas, the Voting Rights Act actually forces us to pack them into districts to achieve the same numbers that are under old census lines, instead of looking at and saying, what are the real communities of interest here? How many representatives do these particular areas need? What are the important issues for the state that need to be addressed? And those are the things that should be taken into consideration, more importantly than race. But because of the Voting Rights Act, the very first question that's asked is, let's look at race. And I don't think that's what the intent of Dr. King and the marchers in Selma was to say, let's look at race first. I think what they were trying to march for and what the civil rights movement was about was, let's all be equal and let's all be on a level playing field. And while the Voting Rights Act, and particularly Section 5, attempted to achieve that early on, I think we've outlived its usefulness because it's now become a political tool. And I think you can see that in a lot of different cases. Most notably, I think you can see it in Philadelphia, when the new Black Panther Party has two men dressed in all black with black berets on, holding batons outside of a polling location, denying people the right to go in and vote. And the Justice Department comes in and says, that's wrong, and we're going to prosecute them for it under the Bush administration. And as soon as the Obama administration comes in, they drop the case. Or when you have places like Knoxby County, Mississippi, where Ike Brown ran an entire operation that had to, that revolved around mail-in ballot fraud, and the Justice Department goes in several times, investigates, and they never find anything wrong. Until finally the Attorney General of the state of Mississippi decides to prosecute Ike Brown, and he pleads guilty. Same thing happens in Hale County and Perry County, Alabama, where again, Justice Department sent in observers over and over again, never found anything wrong. They had a change in administration in Alabama. The Alabama Attorney General prosecutes. You have three people who confess and plead guilty. And then, of course, you have the case in Georgia of Johnson versus Miller, where the federal district court actually chastises the Justice Department for actually colluding with plaintiffs in the case to affect a political outcome. And that's what Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has turned into. It's turned into a political tool, and that's why it needs to be done away with.
Okay, we're going to open this up now to the audience. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to step up to the microphone and bring your questions up. I have a question that we received through the email, and I'll bring it up right now. Recently, when I applied for a passport, my Texas birth certificate was rejected because it was an abstract and not a certified copy as required by the State Department. I applied online to the Texas Department of State Health Service for a long-form birth certificate. As part of the process, they required that I have my Texas driver's license to prove where I was. No problem since I have a Texas driver's license, but what if I didn't have a Texas driver's license? Does that mean I can't get a certified copy of my birth certificate? More to the point, how could I get a Texas driver's license or ID to satisfy the Texas voter ID law without a certified copy of my birth certificate that I can't get without a driver's license? So it's sort of a catch-22 there for people trying to prove who they are. And so I will kick that to you and Mr. Trainer about how does that work. This, sure. This becomes a barrier to people who want to exercise sure. their right to vote.
Well, Senate Bill 14 has provisions in it, the voter ID law that's at issue, has provisions in it for free identifications to be provided, and they're not driver's license. If you show up and say, I need an ID, a picture ID issued by the department to vote, they'll give you an ID, and that's in the law. And the reason it's in the law is because that was what was required in order to meet the muster that the Supreme Court set forth in the Indiana, the first case to make it to the Supreme Court, the Indiana voter ID law was challenged and there. And more importantly, when Georgia, the only state that's had the issue litigated before the Supreme Court and the only Section 5 covered jurisdiction, the Georgia legislation, when it went up the first time, did not have the provision of free identification in it. And the Supreme Court found that to be a poll tax. So the inclusion of a free ID actually eliminates all of the concerns about whether or not someone can or can't get. As long as you go in and hold out that you're using the ID for voting, you have to be given the ID. And I think it's important to remember when we talk about voter ID, and we often hear this red herring of, well, there's a concern about mail-in voter fraud, and that's where the real problem is. Well, federal law already requires that for the very first time that you vote by mail, you actually have to include a copy of a photo identification with your registration to receive the ballot the first time that you vote by mail. And so actually federal law has a requirement in place that takes care of a lot of the identification requirements going forward. Now, we can't obviously for people who were grandfathered on the rolls to receive mail-in ballots, they're going to continue to receive.
Representative Martinez-Fisher, I mean, how does it look from your other aisle, the aisle?
I think from the beginning, and it really, I don't think, I mean, there's obviously this issue of how Democrats and Republicans feel about it, but let's just look at it from the voters' perspective. The state of Texas declared winners and losers when they decided what forms of IDs they would accept and which forms they wouldn't. And so it's perfectly acceptable to vote with a concealed handgun license. I'm curious how many people have them. I have one, and I'm sure a few of you in the crowd do too, but not everyone does. But you cannot use a state-issued ID for state employees that are issued by DPS, the same state agency that will be issuing out these free identifications to go and vote. We can use our driver's license or military ID, but we cannot use a college ID. We seem to forget that when we apply or register to vote, we have to identify ourselves by our Social Security and our driver's license number. When those are screened at the Secretary of State's office, they look for matches and mismatches. And if there is a mismatch, guess what? When you go to vote, guess what you have to produce? An ID. And so we have a pretty sophisticated system already. And what we have in this law now is a series of setups to where if you show up and you vote a provisional ballot, the law says you have to come back and prove who you are within a couple of days or your vote's not going to count. How many of you have stood in line to go vote once? And how many of you are willing to go back a second time after you voted? And what I think is that when we talk about this in the abstract and the 30,000-foot view, it sounds really nice and rosy. But when we take it down to the individual level And you look at somebody like my mother. I use my mother all the time because she was my campaign manager. She was a precinct chair, and she's been voting in Glen Oaks Elementary ever since it's been an elementary school. My mother has Parkinson's, so she doesn't have a driver's license. And with Parkinson's, she's definitely not going to go out and get a concealed handgun license. And she's not doing a lot of traveling these days, so she doesn't have a passport. But she's been voting at Glen Oaks Elementary since it opened and was a voting site. And what do we do for people like her when she wants to vote? How do we tell her that it's okay, your vote is counted all of your life, but all of a sudden, because we've changed directions because of this illusion of a problem, we're going to make it problematic for you? Is it fair to my mom? It certainly isn't. Is it fair for people like my mom? It certainly isn't. Was it even discussed in the formation of the legislation? Absolutely not. The reason why these IDs are free is because it was challenged on the floor of the House, because it was determined that when the state would give out a free ID, lo and behold, our structure of government has decided that we are going to put highways on a credit card and pay it with bonds and use money to service those bonds and pay the debt service. Well, guess what? When you start giving away free IDs that are being counted on to make payments for road projects, you've all of a sudden violated several bond covenants with the companies that have lent you and businesses that have lent you this money to build these roads. All of a sudden, you have a big problem. And so Texas didn't fix this for the sake of accommodating the voters. They fixed this because they knew they had a violation of their public finance and their public debt agreements with people who build roads and toll roads and things like that. That's why it was fixed. And I can tell you that because I was in the debate. And so there is some advantage of being on the inside. As this goes forward to the Department of Justice, I mean, I immediately recognize that there are many people who are in this state that don't have IDs, don't have a pathway to get it, and there is no flexibility within the system to allow these people the ability to go out and vote. We have said, let's make voting fraud and voter impersonation, let's make it a felony to send people to jail, throw them under the jail. But let's make it easy for everybody who wants to vote, rejected very quickly on party lines.
Okay, we have some participants. You have a question, sir.
Yes, sir. My name is Randy Baer. I'm just a member of the community. I appreciate Dr. Flores and Gilbert explaining Section 5 and why it was there. It was essentially, and what I've heard it referred to, is it's a speed bump in those states that had past history. And I understand about the past history aspect, but we have to go to the current day. And the interesting part I have to do is I have to kind of go back to Trey Trainer here on this. I look at CD-26. Which the history on that is it's Tarrant County and it's Denton County. And the original map drawn by the past legislature when you mentioned communities of interest, it was very interesting to see this finger of a district that extended into Tarrant County but had all of Denton County. And so it's hard to see the community of interest there, first of all, whenever the prior districts were really Fort Worth. So the legislature passed that without preclearance. That particular district would have been enacted. With preclearance, it stopped it. And basically had a review. And A.G. Abbott basically conceded, and the new district actually looks better. It has just a small part of the north of Tarrant County. So I have to ask you a question on this. When you talk about communities of interest and you talk about this no need for this thing, how do you reconcile that with the fact that we had a legislature that actually put a district in like that, and actually we found out that that was not a good district? So that's where I'm at on that.
Well, first of all, I would challenge whether or not we had found out that it's a good district or not. What we have in place now is an interim map. The case is still ongoing before the district court in the District of Columbia that'll make determinations as to whether or not there was any type of discriminatory intent involved. The process of redistricting and the outcome of the way these districts looks a lot of times is a function of geography, and it's a function of the requirement of the Constitution to have exactly equal population, particularly with regard to congressional districts like you mentioned. So when you have to have the exact number of people with no deviation whatsoever, you're going to end up with odd districts. Otherwise, we'd be able to take whole counties and put them together, and we'd have deviations a lot like the lines in the House maps that look a lot cleaner. So it makes it very difficult when you have to, and of course we all want to comply with the 14th Amendment and make sure that everybody has one person, one vote as the standard. But it forces those type of draws of districts where you end up with odd configurations, and of course that happens throughout the map where you have little portions of counties and little portions of cities that get severed off to meet federal constitutional requirements.
And I do want to remind our listeners that this is the Texas Public Radio Town Hall meeting on the Voting Rights Act. And Gil, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, you know, I think that if we look at the history of the state, I mean, there is gerrymandering has always occurred. I mean, Democrats were in power for a long time, and it occurred there, and Republicans have been in power more recently, and it's occurred. But you know, the bigger issue is there, you know, the intent to discriminate along racial or ethnic lines. And I think that the argument that Greg Abbott makes is that the, you know, Section 5 has done its job, and we've elected, you know, African American and Latino elected officials over the last 40 some years, and that we're past that. But I think that the deeper question is, do we still need it as a deterrent? I mean, have we achieved this, and is it no longer necessary? Is it have we changed so much that there's no need for it anymore, or are we? Is there that need for that deterrent to continue to make sure that the state continues to follow those guidelines?
And Dr. Flores?
Yeah, just to expand on what Gilbert was saying and to comment a little bit on Mr. Rodriguez's comment about Naleo's showing the increase in Latino elected officials. Naleo will actually tell you that the increase of in Latino officials over the last, and they keep track every year. I get a directory of every Latino elected and appointed official in every state of the union, from Arturo Vargas. He says, "With my compliments, Dr. Flores." So I keep them. So I've got this long database of going back, I don't know how many years of their data. And it's a very clear line. It shows his increase. But he'll be the first one to tell you, and they've done research at Naleo to show this, that there's a direct result of this increase is a direct result of the imposition of the Voting Rights Act, and particularly Section 5. So it works to increase representation, for one. Now, the whole issue about fraud is very interesting. If you go, and I invite you to Google whenever you get home or whatever, Google the Brennan Center for Justice, and look at their research that they've conducted on fraud, electoral fraud. And the three states that they've looked at, they've found incidences ranging from 2/10,000 of 1% to 4/10,000 of 1% occurrences of voter fraud. This whole issue about voter fraud is a red herring. You know, and I invite anybody who claims that the voter ID laws or any other kind of provisions they want to put in place is to prevent voter fraud, to come up with a research to show how much voter fraud really is going on. Because I venture to say that there's not as much as people are made to think there is.
Okay, we have another question from the floor.
Hello, I am Matthew Sheridan, a senior at the School of Science and Technology. And I wanted to address a question to everybody, but I wanted to comment on Mr. Rodriguez's assessment about what racism. I agree that there is tons of diversity in the Latino culture, and we do have people that vote both conservative and liberal on issues. But I'd like to say that there are correlational studies that show that more Hispanic people tend to vote Democratic. And I would think that in a legislation that can look at that when drawing lines, they would know they could use that to an advantage to either gerrymander or put an advantage for them in re-election. So my main question is, why do we have the people who are responsible, or why do we have the people who are getting elected to power draw the lines that are going to determine, you know, who votes for them and puts them in power? Why don't we have some other organization or maybe some national organization do this or go to a PR system?
Okay, so he was addressing you, Mr. Rodriguez. You want to respond?
It seems to me that what you're asking is why not have a commission or a bureaucracy that would establish it?
Which some states have.
Yeah, and that's fine. That's fine, but I oppose that. I think that runs contrary to what the ideals of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. So therefore, you know, I don't think that's something that we want to do. The idea is that a political party wins the votes based on what they are preaching, promoting, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, from my point of view, that would be a disaster. That would be a disaster. Now,
well, can you elaborate? What's a disaster?
A disaster. A disaster is when people claim that they don't have it is when people claim that there is no need for voter identification, and there is. When people claim that there is no research, and the research being done is being done by people who promote the idea of no need for voter registration. I think that that's the headache that I see. And what we've got right now is a situation where, again, I insist that this is a political situation. This is not an issue related to race or ethnicity. This is a political situation where Democrats are upset that they have lost. And the reason that they have lost, it's their own fault. It's not anybody else's. I mean, they have painted themselves into a corner in the message that they put forth. And I am very, very proud and happy that the Tea Parties had something to do with promoting and pushing the victories of so many Republicans, a Republican majority, into the state Senate and into the state House for the first time in a long time. And thus, it was the vote. It was voters that said, this is what we want. And now for the Justice Department or for the losing party to try to reverse that and try to say, no, that's not fair. What's not fair?
I think it's important to, when you consider looking at whether or not you have a commission or some other mechanism in place, the Texas Constitution guarantees a Republican form of government, and the federal Constitution assigns the redistricting obligation to the legislature. Now, the legislature can change that anytime they want to. But I think it would take a vote of the citizens of the state of Texas to change the Constitution to take that authority away from the legislature to do it. And if you think it's going to be any better, I mean, you need to look any further than Arizona to see what happened just recently with their adoption of a commission and the back and forth. I mean, a commission can be just as partisan as the legislature can be, and in some instances it can be more partisan. At least when the legislature meets, they meet in public, they have an open public debate, Representative Martinez Fisher gets to express his views, the press is there, covers everything. It's very possible for a small commission of 5, 6, 8 people, however many you put on there, to collude together at any time. And then come out and have a public vote. So I think it's a much more fair process when you have open public committee meetings. I know in 2003, I mean, there were busloads of people during the congressional redistricting who were coming in from all over the state to address the committee. The legislature has the resources. They went out and had hearings all over the state for that. So I think there's much more public input into the process when you have the legislature involved.
And Republican Senator Jeff Wentworth of San Antonio has been pushing a plan that would create some sort of committee that would change the way things are done, sort of like what this young man has suggested. Now, Representative Fisher, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I did. I think that Georgia intrigued me here. We try to position this, that this is just a fight between Republicans and Democrats. And I get that. That's easy. That's easy to sell. That's easy for people to understand because Republicans and Democrats are always going at it. But let's just look at the facts in the context of the Voting Rights Act. We're talking about a state that over the course of a decade grew by 4.2 million people in 10 years. That is huge. 3.7 million of those people were minority. And 2.7 million of those people were Latino. And when you look at this through the lenses of race and not politics, you will see what was the result of Texas growing so fast. In Congress, that meant 4 new seats. The last time that happened in the state of Texas, it was the 1860s. It was after the Civil War. It was during Reconstruction. Probably won't happen again in my lifetime, may not happen in my daughter's lifetime. This is significant. We grew 4 new seats because of that growth. And let's look at the scoreboard. When the legislature finished, that robust growth that we talked about resulted in 0 net gains for minorities in Congress and -6 seats in the Texas House. How is that about politics? That's about race. And there's clearly an issue of people who try to mask themselves with race to get into the Voting Rights Act litigation because that's the only way they can save their political skins. But there are true litigation teams out there that are looking at this through the lenses of minority groups. The NAACP, MALDEF, our caucus. We are the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus, and we are mostly comprised of Democrats. And so it would surprise people to know that one of the biggest positions that we advance, that we have not given up on, is the creation of a state rep district in West Texas that Barack Obama received 29% of the vote. Now tell me that that's about politics. We can elect a Latino Republican in West Texas in the communities of Lubbock, Midland, and Odessa that President Obama received 29% of the vote has nothing to do with politics, has everything to do with race. And so that is a big, that is a significant point. And when you go to these commissions, it's important to understand that how you structure it is everything. What Trey was referring to in Arizona, they created a commission, and then Governor Brewer of Arizona called a special session so that she could impeach the head of the commission because she didn't think that the head of the commission was doing a good job. And guess who funds the commission? The state of Arizona. The revenues are derived from the legislature in Arizona. So if they control the purse strings and they can control who's in and who's out, how independent is it? And Jeff Wentworth's proposal is a great idea, and I've talked to people about it publicly, but it says if nothing gets done by August 31st of redistricting year, then they do no more. And then you go back to where we started, which is the courts. And so I think the Voting Rights Act is a impressive piece of legislation. It should serve as both a sword and a shield. And states should know that what happened in a state like Texas, if it can be done in a state like a state of Texas and have no voter rights, pre-clearance issues or litigation issues, protections from the court, then there is nothing that can be stopped when it comes to states making decisions to put race aside and to expand political power on the backs of minority communities. And that's simply not what we can have happen in the 21st century.
Well, some people on the conservative side of the argument would say that's a scare tactic, mm-hmm. that you're saying if we lose the Voting Rights Act, that it would be off to the races in the sense of taking away minority opportunities to vote.
And I would say that if it's a scare tactic, I mean, it's the truth. I mean, since 1970, Texas has been a covered jurisdiction since 1970. Legislators in Washington, I believe Senator Benson and Barbara Jordan, asked for Texas to be included in the list of covered jurisdictions. And ever since 1970, Texas has received an objection from the Department of Justice. Happened in the 70s, Democrats were in control. Happened in the 80s, Democrats were in control. Happened in the 90s, Democrats were in control. Happened in 2000, Republicans are in control. It happened in it has not happened in 2010 yet. That is being litigated, but we know that the Department of Justice has issued an objection in their complaint, and that's currently before the district court, before the District of Columbia. So the statistics aren't on the side of people who say it's a scare tactic. I think that Texas has been pretty consistent on being on the other side of the Voting Rights Act since 1970.
Dr. Flores, we've heard the accusation or being brought up, the characterization that the Democrats have a race-based message, and we're talking about race versus politics. And is there a strategy behind if someone wanted to limit Democratic votes that they would suppress Mexican Americans from getting to the ballot box to do that?
You know, I've been involved in three rounds of redistricting as an expert witness. And in the 1991 round, I worked for the Republican Party. And 2003 round, it was for MALDEF. And this round, I worked. I'm part of the reason that we're having late elections. I apologize to the public, but I was one of the testifying experts in this Perry v. Pettis v. Perry, Texas redistricting round. My job is to identify racial intent in redistricting. How can you show that race is the principal variable in the redistricting process, that race is being used? One of the things I did find I worked for MALDEF in these last two rounds. MALDEF is nonpartisan, so that the chief attorney will tell you, and I will tell you, that MALDEF doesn't really care whether Republicans or Democrats get elected to office. The important thing is that Latinos get elected to office. If they're Republican Latinos, that's fine. Democratic Latinos, that's fine too, but it's Latinos. And one of the things that I discovered was that
in the areas of high population growth in this state is in the Latino community, where the Latino community is the most dense. And there were no congressional districts drawn in those areas. Latino communities were either chopped up or packed in other areas, and because the redistrictors, which were Republican attorneys working for the Attorney General's office and the Texas Legislative Council, telling the Texas Legislative Council what to do, working for the Speaker's office. I have copies of all their memos and emails and everything because I had to use those. That was evidence in the court of law. It was very clearly that they were manipulating the Hispanic population to draw districts the way they wanted them to come out, which meant white Republican politicians would get elected to office. It was very simple. It was very, very I did this nice little table for a judge to show that in one congressional district, 23, that had grown to 149,000 more population, so they had to pare out 149,000 people. The redistrictors manipulated over 600,000 people just to get the right 149,000 moved out. And the way they did it was they moved out those Latino district precincts around the periphery and the edge of the congressional district that turned out in large numbers that would not vote because they were thinking all Latinos are Democrats, so if we leave those precincts in, they're going to elect a Democrat to that congressional district. They moved them out and brought in other precincts that were low-performing Latino precincts because they knew that the white Anglo, quote-unquote, Republicans would outvote the low-performing Latinos in those precincts. Was race being used to manipulate the lines on a congressional district? Absolutely. Absolutely. Was the Republican redistrictors thinking that all Republicans are Anglos and all Latinos are Democrats? Absolutely. That's the way they were thinking. They were thinking this political party was superimposed on race, but race was really the thing that was driving the line drawing.
But let me ask you, isn't 23rd Congressional District, that's Kiko Canseco, right?
That's correct.
Now, he's a Latino.
That's correct.
And MALDEF challenged that.
That's correct.
You said that MALDEF doesn't care if they elect Republicans or Democrats as long as they're Hispanic.
That's correct.
So what happened there?
Congressman Canseco, if you look at the research on his election campaign, he was elected by Anglo voters. The Latino voters in that congressional district didn't turn out.
Elected by Americans.
Well, that's true. That's very true, Mr. Okay. Rodriguez. They're all Americans to vote, whether Latino or Anglos. But in his case, there were Anglo-American Republican voters that came out in large amounts. Thank goodness to the Tea Party organizing over there. I think you all did a wonderful job. But they did not talk to the Latino community, and they didn't turn out to vote. And that's what happened. Matter of fact, Cito Rodriguez got criticized for running a poor campaign and not turning out his vote. Or else he could have probably beaten Canseco in that district. But in that case, it was a very, very clear. If you look at it, Canseco was a preference of the Anglo voters, and Rodriguez was a preference of the Latino voters in that particular congressional district.
Okay, Mr. Rodriguez, go ahead.
First of all, I'm flabbergasted that he makes the comment that MALDEF is not partisan. I know some of the MALDEF people personally.
Now, to be fair, the Tea Party, you're nonpartisan.
We are nonpartisan, but we are conservative. Okay. We are very conservative. But we are very conservative. And the issue here is not necessarily just Democrat and Republican. It is liberal and conservative. And the issue, again, is that, you know, there's an old saying in Spanish, tratan de tapar el sol con un dedo. You try to hide the sun with your finger. The fact of the matter is, again, clearly, in Kiko Canseco's example, folks, he was elected, whether it was by Anglos or Hispanics, he was elected. And what is wrong with that? What is wrong with that? I don't understand how you can punish a state for the behavior of some people 50, 60 years ago. And to keep raising that red herring, and yes, it is, it's a red herring. To keep raising it constantly because it's advantageous politically to you and economically. I mean, not only, I feel very, very strongly. I mean, I worked with Senator Hatch back in the 1980s and during the Reagan administration to get rid of affirmative action, because I think that that is symptomatic of a bigger problem, of the problem that we've got, the balkanization of Americans. And it is very, very sad when you start looking at issues. Well, that Hispanic was not elected by Hispanics, so therefore we got a challenge. I mean, are you hearing yourselves? I'm flabbergasted.
Let's go back to the participants.
Yeah, Juan Gutierrez, community activist. I kind of see the Voting Rights Act, it's almost like a checks and balance, not just for Republicans, but also for Democrats. But I have issues when you start doing this grand thing that you're giving the free ID and everything, yet, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's supposed to be gone through the DPS, yet soon after that, that became one of the things that could be done by the state or through the Attorney General's office. They all of a sudden shut down 40 offices. DPS offices, and I think a lot of them were in rural communities of Latino communities. And now, from what I understand, there's another 40 additional stations, DPS stations, fixing to be closed too. But now, supposedly they're looking to see what the targets are going to be. I think that's the word they use. But that seems a good reason for me to have the Voting Rights Act. Thank you.
We'll pass this along, but first I want to remind our listeners that this is the KSTX Texas Public Radio Town Hall meeting, and we're talking about the Voting Rights Act. Gil, you wanted to take that.
Yeah, I wanted to get back to an earlier point. You know, I think we have to be careful about this idea that, you know, the party that is not in power, that it's sour grapes and that their message hasn't been effective. And I'm not to suggest that this does not happen at times, but I think if you look back historically, you know, in the mid-1960s in Texas, 180 of the 181 people in the state legislature were Democrats. Now, if you had said to the Republicans at that time, you know, nobody likes your message. It's not getting through. So you just got to deal with it. And, you know, that's the fault is with you. Well, it wasn't as simple as that, because we had at-large districts in this state, and the system was set up to make it difficult for Republicans to get elected. And the Voting Rights Act actually initially was very beneficial to the Republican Party for quite a long time. And Trey was pointing out in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, that when Democrats were in power, it was a safeguard for the Republican Party in a sense. So I think that we have to look at the situation as not simply, you know, this one party is their message is failing, and that's what it's all about, because the system can be set up, and it was it was actually set up in a way to prevent Republicans from having power for a long time in the state.
David, if I could, just to the point about the closing of the 40 DPS offices, what that means is that Texas still has more driver's license offices than any other state. I mean, Texas is a very large...
Proportionally?
I mean, Texas is a very large state, and obviously we face some budgetary challenges. Those offices, you know, I don't think anybody in the legislature thought, well, we're closing these offices with the intent of keeping people from being able to vote. And so, again, I think it's this colorization of emotion over the common sense aspects of what we have here. And to the point earlier about you know, the exchange of emails, I think that's directly on point with what I said earlier. It forces people in the legislature, particularly Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, forces the legislature to look at race first and to look at where and how we're going to effectuate race. And it's this, again, this politicization of the act that takes place. I mean, when you have the U.S. Justice Department objecting to Kinston, North Carolina, moving from partisan city council elections to nonpartisan, the citizens of the city voted and said, we want to go to nonpartisan elections. And the Justice Department entered an objection and said, wait, you can't do that. How are we going to be able to identify who the Republicans and Democrats are? And they objected. So Kinston goes, and they file suit in the district court in District of Columbia, and all of a sudden the Justice Department decides, well, maybe we'll reconsider that, and that's fine. Well, the reason why they did that is because they knew that they were putting Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act on the fast track to be struck down as unconstitutional. Because you can't say that when the citizens of a community decide they want to have nonpartisan elections, and you can't say, well, you can't identify who the Republican and Democrat is, that you're not actually politicizing the Voting Rights Act. And more importantly, when we look at the voting, I mean, the real problem with the Voting Rights Act and what we've talked about here tonight is really Section 5. It's the preclearance requirement. It's whether or not the state of Texas, and really only a few states, not all states, a few states, have to go get permission from the federal government to take action. Now, if it was an application to all states, that may change the nature of what this debate is, but it's not. But Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which really does protect minority communities and gives them an opportunity to go to court and to challenge actions that are truly egregious. We haven't heard any discussion of Section 2, but because Section 2 works just fine. It's Section 5 that's become the political tool.
Mr. Traynor, thank you very much for that. And Ms. Martinez.
Just 30 seconds. I think, you know, there's a lot of inside baseball in redistricting, and what Dr. Flores was referring to when he said these emails, there was evidence that was emails exchanged by folks who were drawing these lines. And when Trey says, well, you know, you can tell from these emails that people are looking at race, well, I want to be clear. These emails were looking at race. They weren't looking at using race to protect minorities. They were looking at race to destroy communities. And you will see email after email to say, well, what do we need to do in this area that we can give the illusion of a Hispanic majority seat, but we know because we can look at election data that these minorities are not voting. And so on the surface, it looks like it's a 50% plus Hispanic district, but we know it really isn't because they don't vote. And so the minorities will never have the opportunity, if they even came together on their best day, they wouldn't elect a candidate of their choice. I want to be very, very clear about that. And there are dozens of emails that speak to that. And secondly, I don't think anyone thought, including the colonel of the Department of Public Safety, that he was going to be in the business of issuing IDs for people to go out and vote. We know that we could do this with same-day registration right at the precinct poll as it takes place. If you have a good ID and if all you need, that's all you need to vote, well, then why can't we use that to register people same day and let them vote in the primary and the general election? The fact of the matter is I want my state troopers out there defending our states and protecting us from drug dealers and drug traffickers and human traffickers and all the bad things that they ought to be protecting us from, not going around putting people behind a desk to make you prove who you are in order for you to vote in your general or your primary election. I think we have our priorities backwards, and I think the department will be the first one to tell you that. They are not equipped to handle what's to come with voter ID, and they'd rather have someone else do it. And that's why we said, let's be commonsensical, like Trey suggested. Let's exempt the military. Let's exempt veterans. Let's exempt seniors that have been doing this for a very long time. Let's let the county decide if this is the best direction for a county to go. Let's have local control. That is a big talking point in lots of political circles, to have local control. Let the local county decide if this is something that they want to do in their county. Let's give them that control, that choice. All those things rejected. This wasn't about coming up with a common sense solution. This was about how are we going to make something very difficult, and we're going to pass it, and we're just going to stick together, and we'll vote it down 99-45, you know, every time there's an amendment. And that's exactly what happened.
Let's go back to the floor. Yes, ma'am.
I'm obliged to speak just because there's no women on your panel tonight. My name is Tanya Aguilar Garduño, and I'm here as an individual, not as pertaining to any political party, just from community. And I just wanted to know I guess my question is about the guidelines that the Supreme Court issued to our three judge panels here in Texas, and what do you all feel that basically, I guess, how it redefines the continuation of the Voting Rights Act in terms of coalition districts.
You want to take that? Mr. Flood?
I'm happy to.
Okay. Mr. Traynor?
I think they were very clear that this concept of coalition districts, this concept that's been attempted to be litigated by it was attempted in LULAC versus Perry, and again it's been attempted here in the Perez litigation. It's been attempted in several other pieces of litigation, that you can put these coalitions of minorities together and somehow or another they're protected. The jurisprudence
of the Voting Rights Act makes it very clear that you have to have a majority of a particular minority group in place. And I think the Perry versus Perez decision mentions that specifically, that this, you know, if the court there was attempting to create a coalition district, one, it can't do it, and two, it didn't have any justification if that's what they were trying to do. And they mentioned that specifically with regard to the initial Congressional District 33 that was drawn. I think we're coming to the end of this attempt to create coalition districts. And we're now moving more towards the traditional going through the various factors of there's some case law. It's called the Jingles factors as to whether or not there's cohesive voting among a minority community and whether they're compact enough to constitute being created into a district. So I think what at the end of this litigation, I think what we'll see is a very firm determination that coalition districts don't have to be drawn and aren't a necessity for a covered jurisdiction.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, my name is Kamala Platt. Usually when I get up to ask a question, it's because I'm like really inspired about something wonderful that I feel like is happening. But today I'm confused, and I guess the confusion, maybe you can help me out. I came because I heard on the radio this is going to be about the Voting Rights Act, and that's a federal, as my understanding, I'm not a legal scholar, but my understanding is that that's a federal act that we as states participate under. And what I'm hearing is people from a particular state who for whatever reasons are calling it things like red herring and unconstitutional without having legitimate reasons for doing that. And I feel like, you know, I have family and extended family that marched for that suffered and were in prison, and you know, I know people that lost their lives in this struggle to have this and make this a better country. And I don't understand why, I mean, how we can have, I'm not saying that, you know, everyone has a right to say and feel whatever they like, but I don't feel like, I mean, this is, I trusted the public radio station, I trust Trinity University, I don't feel like this is up to our standards for what we should be discussing in terms of this. It is a difficult issue in terms of the redistricting and all of that, but I'd like to ask if we can somehow raise the level of the discussion and really bring it up to what the Voting Rights Act demands of us. Thank you.
Dr. Flettis.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on that. As you saw from the program, I've testified in a lot of different cases, and one of the things I've told the lawyers over the years is that what's missing in these cases, and what's very, very sad about these cases, is that the human stories of the sacrifice and the pain that people who have had injustices brought against them because that have given rise to these lawsuits don't get into the court record. These trials boil down to a bunch of technicians and academics and statisticians talking about all kinds of line drawing and software packages, this, that, and the other. But they don't talk about, the beatings that go on in some rural communities because a Latino boy decided to date an Anglo girl, and his brothers found out about it, and they dragged him out, and so forth. But that's one line drawn in that community that you can't not cross. That's part of the evidence that I testified to. I dig up stuff like that, and I present it in the courtroom. But the people involved, I've worked in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and those of you who are old enough to understand the history of the Voting Rights Act and know the name of that town know what a horrible nightmare and secret those people have to live with. The psychology in that community, the environment in that community is so depressive to this day. They've got a collective guilty conscience for the murders that occurred in that community because of the Voting Rights Act. And those stories just don't make it into the trials.
Instead, it's a bunch of lawyers and a bunch of suits and a bunch of PhDs talking about stuff that don't count. And this woman, I missed her name, is very true. We need to raise this discussion to a higher level. This is a law that protects the constitutional right of a group of people or groups of people who have been denied the right to participate in a democracy. Been denied the right to participate in a democracy because of their color or the language that they speak. These laws, Section 5, is a law that forces the state to obey the Constitution of the United States. Fundamentally, period, that's it. That's really what we need to be talking about. But we do get bogged down in technicalities. But anyway, I just needed to make that statement, David.
And I do want to point out that we did begin the discussion by, you know, bringing up and hearing what happened at the Edmund Pettus Bridge outside of Selma, and trying to draw a big bold line back to that event and showing that this is about people. It's not just about abstract numbers. Mr. Traynor, you wanted to weigh in.
Sure. I think what Dr. Flores has pointed out is that a court of law, justice can be blind a lot of times. In fact, we want it to be. Section 5 is a complete distortion of the regular course of business in a lawsuit. It requires the state to prove that you weren't racist in what you did. It's not that evidence is put on that you did do something that's wrong. It's that you have to go in and prove that you didn't do something wrong. And so it completely changes the course of our jurisprudence and how we've always faced legal cases in this country. And that's what happens there. And yes, I will admit that there are a lot of times that personal stories, when you're dealing with the entire state of Texas, 254 counties, the millions of people in the population moves in the very short period of time. We could address all the individual issues that we wanted if we didn't have to have a primary election in May. You know, we could spend hours upon hours hearing testimony of folks, but you can't do that. At some point, you have to get down to the what the districts are going to look like, where people are going to go vote. As an attorney, I'm always thankful to have people like Dr. Flores to come and testify and to speak to various issues that we need expert testimony on. But at the end of the day, you've got to get down and you've got to have the elections.
Let's go back to the floor. Yes, sir.
My name is Raphael Williams. I am a citizen of the east side of San Antonio, Texas. And I am amazed at the framing of this debate in terms of conservative and liberal and Democrat and Republican. I'm amazed that a conservative would use, and always does use, Dr. Martin Luther King as a platform to discriminate against the very people that he supported. I'm amazed that they would be constitutionalist when the Constitution was not built for women or minorities or people of color. And that you say that it's a red herring. You say that there's no need to discuss race because we're in the post-Obama racialist society. But if what Dr. Flores says is that 3 out of the 4 million people who grew here in the state of Texas should not equate out to 3 out of 4 districts being represented by the people who are responsible for that growth, explain to me how you think that that's not fair, and explain to me how you think that there is no history currently when the biggest stories of the news of the past week are of a sexist man saying something about women and an institution, a status quo, a conservative status quo institution not recognizing or acting on the murder of a young man. That's the reason why there is a Voting Rights Act. How do you not see that that's the reason for there not being a Voting Rights Act?
Mr. Rodriguez, you want to take that?
First of all, let me say that I am not saying that there is no racism. Racism and adultery and murder, all of those things are around. This young lady that spoke a little while ago about legitimate reasons, let me tell you that when I registered at Highland Park Elementary in 1955, my first year, my mother registered me, and I was one of five or six Hispanic kids to enter that that school. And I remember the racism. So you can't tell me that there's no legitimate reason that I can speak, because I do have, I feel I have a very legitimate background on this issue. The issue, my friends, is that it's how this law is being applied. It's my understanding from my readings and my listening to speeches by Dr. King that he wanted a race neutral. He did not want a situation where race was taken into consideration. That's what he was fighting. And it seems to me like this is exactly what, that is exactly the exact reverse of what has happened. I mean, just as was classically said a little while ago, Canseco apparently is not Hispanic enough. You know, I don't know what, you know, it means to have resegregation of Hispanic districts so that we can have Hispanic districts, have resegregation of or continued segregation of black districts so that there can be a black representative. I mean, that just seems to fly in the face. Instead of having an integrated society, instead of having or promoting a political diversity, it seems like we just like the opposite is happening. So, yes, you know, I do believe that there's still racism, but I also believe that there's also still murder. I believe that you have to have laws against all of those things. But I also believe that these are moral questions as well as legal questions. And I believe in the Constitution just the way that it was written, because within the Constitution there are laws that there is a way by which the change can be accomplished without getting into the streets, without any type of violent protest. There is a way to do it. And I think that that is the beauty of our country. And those that want to change the law can do it. And it's that simple. I am a proud conservative Hispanic. And I'm not going to apologize for that. I'm sorry. No, I'm sorry for you.
Okay, yes, ma'am.
My name's Caitlin Earhart, and I'm a senior in high school. But I just want to, y'all were talking about, and the whole premise of this is getting rid of the writing the Voting Rights Act. And so I was wondering if, in getting rid of it, if we're just getting rid of the Section 5, the whole idea of getting rid of it, is it just the Section 5 that's more debatable, or is it the entire thing, like you said, Section 2 that was actually, like, proven?
Well, Mr. Traynor.
I think Section 5 is the most egregious portion of the Voting Rights Act. And just to put it in practical terms, if Texas and all the other southern states were required to pay 25% more of their income taxes than every other state, we would all think that was egregious. And that's what Section 5 says, is that these states in the southern part of the United States, some Indian reservations out west, some communities so a couple of the boroughs in New York, you're being singled out and applied to you the law differently than the rest of the country. I think that applies to the Voting Rights Act. I mean, it applies to the voter ID question as well. I mean, that's why the Georgia voter ID question is so important for the state of Texas, is because it's a Section 5 covered jurisdiction. So I think when we talk about the most troubling part of the Voting Rights Act, it is Section 5. And again, it's the one that reverses the roles when we go to court, where you have to prove that you're not being racist. Whereas Section 2, you bring a normal lawsuit saying, my rights have been violated. And again, do we really need that? I don't know that we do. There's already federal law that covers that anyways. And, you know, 42 U.S.C. 1983 covers the state acting against someone's civil rights anyways, whether it be the 13th, 14th, or 15th Amendment. And it applies to the states. And so, you know, there are other laws out there that have been around a lot longer than the Voting Rights Act has that can be used to do the same thing. So there are problems with other parts of the Voting Rights Act, but Section 5 is the most egregious.
So we would get rid of all of it? That's just what I'm asking. In trying to get
would the Supreme Court likely just strike out Section 5?
Well, and, you know, given the way that the Supreme Court addresses constitutional questions, I think that they would start with Section 5. And they've been presented that opportunity a couple of times. So, you know, the Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District challenged Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and instead of dealing with the constitutional question, they went to a different part of the Voting Rights Act and said, well, you have the opportunity to bail out, and we're going to let you avail yourself of that. So, you know, the Supreme Court, it's a weighty topic when they decide the constitutionality of a hard-fought piece of legislation like the Voting Rights Act. And so I think they will take a minimalist approach and say, well, if Section 5 is what's being challenged, and that's what is being challenged both out of Tennessee and out of the state of Texas right now, so I think that's probably going to be the first step. Now, could that ultimately lead to Section 2 being challenged down the road? Possibly. But, you know, right now the near term is Section 5.
And Dr. Flores, what would Texas look like if Section 5 is struck?
Well, let's see. I wrote a long list of things that it looked like before Section 5 existed, including poll taxes and arbitrarily changing polling places. Section 5, though, is the enforcement section. So it forces a jurisdiction to follow the law. Section 2 allows someone to sue a jurisdiction because they suspect that a violation of the law has occurred. Now, the difference between the two is that in Section 5 is an automatic trigger. The jurisdiction has to go to the Department of Justice for preclearance to show that they're obeying the law or they're in violation of the law. Section 2 requires that one of you citizens out there decide there's a violation of a voting rights law and then find an attorney that can really argue your case well, come up with the money to go to court and take the whole thing. That's the difference. For them to say that Section 5 is the most egregious, if Section 5 were to be overturned, it would gut the entire Voting Rights Act. It really would. So that's the Supreme Court wouldn't have to strike the rest of it down. Section 5 would just kill the whole thing.
Well, we're running out of time here, but Mr. Rodriguez, you wanted to comment.
Thank you. When you're looking at this law, you got to remember, okay, if somebody has committed something wrong, punish that individual. Do not punish an entire state, and certainly don't punish an entire society. That is ridiculous. You've got, if somebody has done something wrong, punish that individual.
So, but how is this punishment? It seems like what it is a corrective measure that may take a span of time, because, you know, we've had decades of centuries of discrimination and prejudice.
Enforcement is, in my book, in my interpretation, enforcement is a form of punishment, because, again,
so ensuring that we have fair elections is a
but
form
we're not
of punishment.
Doing that. We are not doing that with Illinois. We're not doing that with Ohio. We're doing it with Texas. We're selecting a state. We're selecting a group of states that... You know, I mean, zeroing in on that.
I hear the audience talking about based upon history. And, you know, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, it didn't apply to the state of Texas. Texas didn't have the Voting Rights Act applied to it until 1973. And the only reason that Texas had the Voting Rights Act applied to it was because of language barriers.
Exactly.
And requiring Texas to print ballots in both Spanish and English. And requiring Texas to print polling locations in both Spanish and English. It had nothing to do with the fact that Texas had the whole start of the act revolves around whether or not there's a test or a tax in place to cover a jurisdiction. It didn't apply to Texas because of that. We weren't keeping people from voting. There were language barriers that have been corrected. And I don't think anybody thinks that if Section 5 goes away, that the state of Texas is going to stop printing ballots in both Spanish and English. Or in Harris County, that they'll continue to print them in the various forms of Chinese dialects that they have to print them in. Because, you know, we've moved beyond that, and it's not Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that's keeping Texas to continuing to do that.
Gil Garcia.
Well, you know, and it's true about Texas, and I think there was politics initially. You know, Lyndon Johnson was president, and I think he was reluctant to have Texas included in that. But you know, I think egregious is a word that I have a lot of trouble applying that to Section 5. It's an extreme measure, and people who supported it initially would say it was an extreme measure, but it was an extreme measure because the situation was extreme, and as I mentioned earlier, the state of Mississippi had 7% African American voter registration in 1965. It's absurd. And to see Alabama going from 19 to 52% in 2 years, Mississippi going from 7 to 60%, this is miraculous. So we can, as I said earlier, I think it's fair to discuss how long Section 5 will be in place, whether it should be permanent, whether it's no longer necessary. But I would really strongly disagree with the idea that this measure has not been a positive part of the election process and that it hasn't had a miraculous effect in the United States.
And the last word will be going to Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher.
Thank you, David. When Texas first became a covered jurisdiction under the Voting Rights Act in 1973, as Trey had mentioned, there was a case called White versus Register. And it's really just sort of serendipity because we're fighting redistricting today in 2011, 2012, and we're doing it in San Antonio, which has been the birthplace of a lot of civil and social justice movements. Well, White v. Register involved San Antonio in the 1970s, and it dealt with drawing single-member districts in both Dallas and in Bexar County so that minorities would have the opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. And that's one of the first things that happened in the 1970s, and frankly, it's still happening today. In 2001, when the legislature drew a map or failed to draw a map, there is a group called the Legislative Redistricting Board. They drew a map. And lo and behold, the Department of Justice under President Bush, George W. Bush, objected. And when that objection came out, Attorney General Cornyn, who's now a United States Senator, guess what he said? He said, well, they only objected to four districts in the state house. I am very proud to say that at least 98% of the map met these requirements of the Voting Rights Act, and we'll happily fix those districts. 10 years later, the Obama Department of Justice says there's a problem with the Texas map, and now it's, we must get rid of Section 5 because it's not working. What has happened in 10 years that we now feel like we have to throw out the baby and the bathwater? And I will say that nobody has mentioned that when the state of Texas decided to sue the United States, which we read very recently, Texas here lately is number one. We're finally first in something. We're first in suing the federal government more times than any other state. This wasn't done. Section 5 wasn't challenged in redistricting. They had the opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of Section 5 in redistricting. So perhaps Attorney General Abbott thinks we still need Section 5 for redistricting. He didn't challenge it there. He threatened to challenge it in voter ID when he said, feds, you approve this law or else we might just have to question the constitutionality of Section 5 now that we know that they have moved forward. But another state has been way out of the gate on this already. And so perhaps if it was easy to get into the Voting Rights Act by having lawmakers say, put my state in that jurisdiction, we represent the will of the people, that's how we got to Congress and the Senate, perhaps we should let them take us out that way. Let's do it legislatively. Why do we have to do it through the courts? No one's done that in the state of Texas. I haven't seen Senator Cornyn, Senator Hutchinson. I haven't seen anybody do that. And so if we're going to do this, let's look at it where the state of Texas puts its priorities. You know, perhaps this is a fair discussion for voter ID. It's pretty clear from the litigation and redistricting that the Attorney General seems to think that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is working just fine. And we've settled a case in large part temporarily based on the offerings of the Attorney General operating on behalf of the state of Texas. So it does work as a sword and a shield, as it should.
All right. Well, thank you very much. That wraps up the Texas Public Radio Town Hall meeting on the Voting Rights Act. I do want to thank our panelists, Dr. Henry Flores, a professor of political science at St. Mary's University, Trey Traynor, an Austin-based attorney specializing in election law and government relations, Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher. He represents District 116, the San Antonio Democrat, George Rodriguez, the president of the San Antonio Tea Party, Gil Garcia, political reporter with Plaza de Armas, and the author of the recently published book, Reagan's Comeback. Also, thanks to NowCastSA.com for carrying this program live. If you're listening to us on the radio, you can also go to NowCastSA.com. www.thefreedomessay.com and check out the video there. Also, thanks to our audience participants. Thank you for coming out this evening and voicing your support and taking part in the democratic process. After all, that is what the Voting Rights Act is all about. I'm David Martin Davies. Have a good night.